Going to get right into our Sunday school lesson, and we're going to be in the book of Hosea. If you didn't get a handout on the way in, raise your hand, let us know, and we'll make sure that you get one. If you didn't get a handout on the way in, make sure everybody has one here this morning. I think that's good. I think we got everybody. All right, thank you, Brother Paul. Happy Father's Day to everybody. We have a little bit of a gift for all of our men here a little bit later on, and so we'll do that here in the second service if you weren't here for the first, and so I won't give away what it is so that you'll be surprised. I feel like the Father's Day traditions and the Mother's Day traditions are slightly different. For all the moms, it seems like everybody comes in, and for all the fathers, everyone like goes camping or something like that. We all go out, and so it just seems to be, I don't know if that's just my perception, but it seems to be the way that it is. But it's good to see all of our families here, good to see all of our men here, so happy Father's Day to you all. I keep trying to reciprocate that back to ladies. I'll walk through the hallway, and a lady will say to me, happy Father's Day, and I'll say, hey, you too, you know, it's just the way that it is. Kind of like you say to your waitress, you know, enjoy your meal, you too, whenever you get your break. I don't know when that's going to be. Hosea chapter 1. I said last time that I had no anticipation of finishing my lesson, but I really needed to preach all three of those chapters together because Hosea chapter 1, 2, and 3 serve as a whole unit that introduces the rest of the book and the rest of the minor prophets. So I'm going to give you the background here a little bit, and I have 1 point left. And it looks like I added a lot to the notes. I didn't. I just expanded some things I had minimized. I resisted the urge to go in and write a whole lot of new stuff. So everything is actually the same. Hopefully we won't get out late today. And so we're going to be in Hosea chapters 1, 2, and 3. And so I'll remind us about where we were. The book of Hosea is one of the most, it begins with one of the most vivid illustrations of that any of the prophets would give. The prophets had 3 primary messages. Now, there's a lot of other things that they go through, but the prophets have 3 primary messages. One is that they commend the people to repent from whatever sins they had been committing, which is usually they'll bring up several primary issues they dealt with: idolatry, injustice, and religious ritualism. And they will call those on the floor and talk about how they need to turn from their wicked ways, turn from their bad thinking back to the Lord. And if they don't, the second major message is that they warn about or promise judgment that will come on them. Their life will not be what they want it to be if they do not turn away from the sin that ruins them. And yet, woven throughout the prophets is this message of restoration and hope. In spite of the judgment we bring on ourselves, there is still hope that God promises to his people out of his love and out of his grace. Now, Hosea introduces a lot of these same topics in a very vivid way. He begins by showing us how big of a deal this really is. And he does that by God illustrating his love for the people by having Hosea, a man of God, marry a promiscuous woman. And so these were my points last week, and I filled in the blanks for you, but just so you can see where we were last week. And we talked about how this whole illustration shows us that the message of the prophets and ultimately the gospel itself is scandalous. Why? Number one, people are scandalously immoral. It doesn't just introduce a woman who's not the greatest woman or that, oh, well, everybody's a sinner. It introduces somebody who was consistently known for sexual immorality. Whether she was a prostitute by vocation or whether it was just like she was a loose woman and gained from it by the people that she built relationships with, either way, she wasn't just bad. She was, in the eyes of regular, everyday people, that's a new level of way to live that I would not want to be associated with. And he wants us to look at our own hearts and lives and realize that our sin is not just understandable, it is scandalously immoral. Number two, in spite of that, God has scandalously covenanted with immoral people. Part of this illustration was not just that this woman was bad, not just that she was that one of the things that even regular society would look down on as being outside of the norm of acceptable behavior. Hosea was told to marry her, and he does. And the Bible says at the very beginning that this was to illustrate God's relationship with his people. He chooses to bring her into his house. He chooses to make a lifelong commitment to her and to be associated with her. It wasn't just something that he did to give out, but in order to attach his name to her and their family. And that takes us to the next point. God's people bring scandalous reproach to this covenant and to God's name. So because of this relationship, this woman brings along with her a reputation. Undoubtedly, there's no way around that. And it gets attached to Hosea by default. Wouldn't it? Well, I mean, it was just his wife. It's not him. Well, he married her. And so their destinies get woven together. And then they illustrate it through the names of their own children, which aren't just her children. They are his children as well. They are his legacy. He names their first son Jezreel. Jezreel is the name of the city that the kings of Israel were building. Jezreel was the place where Jehu had spilled all the blood of the family of Ahab, and it would be the same place where all the blood of Jehu's family, which his last successful son Jeroboam is the one sitting on the throne, would be spilled. It was a city that represented violence and sin. Jezreel. Then he has a daughter and names her Loruhamah, which means not loved. To illustrate how God's people had been not loving. Then he has a third son, or has a third child, a second son, and they name him Lo-Ami, which means not my people, which is directly a reference to when God made a covenant with Israel, and he says, I want you to be my people. But they had chosen to be not his people. And so these three children and the names that he gives them illustrate that the product of our unfaithfulness, even in a covenant relationship with God, has been to bring reproach back to God's name and onto this covenant. And yet it gets worse. And yet it gets worse. Number four, God's people are scandalously unfaithful. You would think that this woman would be thankful that in spite of the reproach she brings to Hosea because of all of her past decisions that she has made, and he chooses to marry her anyway, you would think that she'd move forward in faithfulness. But as is much often the case, she doesn't. And we see in this story that she is found going back to her other lovers after the fact, much like God's people do, where God has shown love to them that they did not deserve, and their bad reputation and sins end up pulling down God's name, but he chooses to enter into that relationship anyway. And then, after all of that, we still remain unfaithful. And the last one that we talked about, number five, God's people are scandalously destitute. We find this woman sitting on a slave market to be sold in chapter 3. And in chapter 2, it describes the judgment that will come on Israel's life as part of this illustration. Hosea and his wife, God and Israel. And he talks about all the judgment that's going to come and how their land is not going to be provided for and their land's not going to have rain and their people aren't going to be prosperous and they're not going to have peace. And that's scandalous because God is their protector. And so God's name is attached to it. So I don't think we fully understand the import of that because we live in a completely different society when it comes to religion. In their world, they were polytheistic. They believed all these gods existed. They believed that every little tribe had their own god that protected them. It was our god. Now, God knows there's only one. That's why he tells the people of Israel, all these other gods, they have eyes but they can't see, they have hands but they can't handle, they have noses but they can't smell, they have ears but they can't hear. But yet he still uses that same way of thinking to illustrate some things. Yahweh was the God of Israel. That means he was supposed to take care of them. He was supposed to protect them. He was supposed to give them peace. He was supposed to provide for their needs. He was supposed to give them rain. And so when God judges his own people because of their sin, God looks weak. Because now Yahweh's not giving them rain, and he's not giving them peace, and he's not taking care of their needs. And oh, apparently Yahweh's not worth anything. And so his name gets attached to their being destitute. And it's scandalous that God would allow that to happen. All of this doesn't even compare, though, with our last point, number six. And this is the positive point that I didn't get to. Last week was harsh, but it was all one message. Number six, God is scandalously forgiving. God is scandalously forgiving. The biggest scandal of this whole illustration, Hosea marrying a promiscuous woman and then her running out on him and her being destitute on the slave market and her naming their kids what they did, all of that doesn't compare to how the story ends. Same thing with God. God covenants with not great people. And they bring reproach on God's name with all their bad decisions and all the sin that they commit. It ends up dragging God's name down, and they continue to live in destitution. They continue to make it worse. They continue to be unfaithful, and God gets associated with it all. And he chose to in the first place, knowing that's what was going to happen, but it doesn't compare to how God promises to treat them yet in the future. If we were God, we would look for the first opportunity where we would be completely justified to throw Israel away. No one would blame God to throw them away at this point. I'm done with you. There's a lot of opportunities God could have thrown us away. I'm done with you. And God would be completely justified in doing it. But part of this illustration was not only what Hosea does at the beginning, but what Hosea does at the end. And I'm going to get to that in a second. But I want us to see is what God does to the people of Israel throughout it all. I gave you one verse first in your notes, Exodus chapter 34. This is part of God's character, where judgment and righteousness comes because God is holy, and it's also inseparably connected with his mercy as well. I want you to read this passage, because this is a very important passage in the Old Testament. The Bible says that the Lord God, is merciful and gracious, long-suffering, and abundant in goodness and truth. There's a whole lot in there. Watch this. Keeping mercy for thousands, forgiving iniquity and transgression and sin. Now, this is what's interesting. And he finishes this short, encouraging moment by reminding them that God does answer sin and brings judgment and will by no means clear the guilty, visiting the iniquity of the fathers upon the children and upon the children's children unto the third and fourth generation. See, he puts those two things together. If God is a good God, he's going to answer sin and react to it. We don't want a God sitting in heaven who doesn't care about evil. I talked about that when we were talking about the problem of evil. We want a God who responds to evil, because when God doesn't respond to other people's evil, we're very upset. God, why aren't you doing anything? We want a God who is holy. And so this is good news. God's judgment is good news. To those who have been hurt, to those who have been oppressed, to those who have been violently mistreated, God's judgment is good news. But sometimes we're the ones who need to receive that because God is holy and we're not. And yet, God is also merciful. Notice the contrast here. He visits the iniquity on the third and fourth generations, but he brings mercy to thousands. There's actually been a study recently shown in genetics where certain decisions that you make perpetually that rewire the way you think, there's some sense in how you mistreat your own mind and your own brain and the way that you develop, you pass a little bit of that on to your kids. And it perpetuates for about three or four generations beyond you. We pass on our decisions to our children and our children's children. But God's mercy is given to thousands in spite of it. Now, I want us to look even in the passage in chapter 1. So be in chapter 1 as we begin. Even in the passage in chapter 1 where he introduces these kids' names, Jezreel, Leruhamah, Lo-Ami, he gives the reason why he names them such terrible names and then reverses it before he gets out of that little section. Look at what he says about his first daughter, verse number 6. She conceived again and bare a daughter. God said unto him, call her name Loruhamah, for I will have no more mercy upon the house of Israel, but will utterly take them away. Verse 7. But I will have mercy upon the house of Judah, and will save them by the Lord their God, and will not save them by bow or by sword or by battle, by horses, nor by horsemen. This is interesting. He's talking about how Israel will be judged, but he still has mercy to give away to unfaithful people. He says, I will have mercy on the house of Judah. And he reminds them about this. He says, you're not going to be saved by yourself. What saves you will not be your sword or your bow or your horses or your horsemen. What saves you will be me. Look at the middle of that verse, verse 7. I will save them by the Lord their God, not by bow or by sword. God will be there for them. And maybe he'll use the sword. Maybe he'll use your paycheck. Maybe he'll use your boss. Maybe he'll use that random stranger driving down the road who stops and gives you some help. He might use those things. But at the end of the day, what saves us is God's mercy that comes from him. So he puts that right in the middle when he even brings up his first daughter. And look, he does the same thing in verse number 8 when he talks about his third child. When she had weaned Loruhamah, she conceived and bare a son and said, God call his name Lo-Ami, for ye are not my people. I will not be your God. Now verse 10. Yet the number of the children of Israel shall be as the sand of the sea, which cannot be measured nor numbered. He puts it in here. Even though judgment comes, he reverses it and promises future mercy. This is a direct reference to what God promises to Abraham. Remember, to Abraham, I gave you the passage in Genesis 22, where he says, your children will be as the sand of the sea that can't be numbered for multitude. He says, in spite of their unfaithfulness, I still promise to give mercy. Now look at verse number 10. And it shall come to pass that in the place where it was said unto them, remember, they named their child Lo-Ami, not my people. It will come to pass in the place that it was said unto them, ye are not my people, there it shall be said to them, ye are the sons of the living God. Now, I'm going to get back to that a little bit later because he's going to say it again. But look what he says in verse 11. Then shall the children of Judah and the children of Israel be gathered together, appoint themselves one head, and they shall come up out of the land, for great shall be the day of Jezreel. Say ye unto your brethren, Ami, and to your sisters, Ruhamah. Say to one another, you are my people, and I will have mercy. It's almost hard to interpret this passage because he says one thing that they deserve, and then he says another thing that they don't deserve. And he couches them next to each other. Judgment comes tomorrow. Joy comes in the morning. This is what happens next. It's what we deserved, but this is what you also will get because I'm merciful to you. And he puts them next to each other so that we see the contrast and we hold in tension God's character between his holiness and his mercy. A lot of these things he's promising are promises that are going to come in the end times, but also in not too far in their distant future. He promises that he will bring them back to the promised land even after they go away from the promised land. He promises they'll gather their people together even those people have been scattered. He promises that they will be under one ruler. One person will lead them that they can trust and they can follow. He promises that they can be called God's people and that they are loved. I want you to see this at the end of chapter 3. Let's flip over to chapter 3. This is how he finishes this whole little section. By the way, our fellows are coming by. If you could take your attendance slip and make sure your name's on it and just drop it in the offering plate, we'd appreciate that. Now I'm going to get to chapter 3 here at the very end, but I want you to look at the end of it, verse number 4. This is where he applies this whole illustration. The children of Israel, verse 4 of chapter 3, shall abide many days without a king, without a prince, without a sacrifice, without an image, without an ephod, without a teraphim. And afterward shall the children of Israel return, seek the Lord their God, and David their king shall fear the Lord and his goodness in the latter days. He says they would be in captivity without leaders, without kings, without princes. They will be over there without their idols and without their religion, but one day they will return to God's land. One day they will seek God. One day they will be ruled by their king, the son of David. That's why David comes up, the son of David. And they will fear, there will be fear of God and goodness in the land. Now, I gave you a bunch of passages in your notes. I want you to look at them. I'm just going to scan through them. These are messages all throughout the prophets in the Old Testament talking about, in spite of their unfaithfulness, God still promises all of these things. Ezekiel tells us, I will make them one nation in the land upon the mountains of Israel, and one king shall be king to them all. Isaiah chapter 9 talks about how God will have that son of David. He'll be called Wonderful and Counselor and Mighty God, and he will sit on the throne of David and rule over his people. In the book of Amos, it says, in that day I'll raise up the tabernacle of David that is fallen. In Micah chapter 5, he says that this ruler whose going forth have been of old from everlasting will be born in Bethlehem and rule over these people. And in Deuteronomy, it describes all of this as well, that they will leave the land, but they'll come back to the land, and even though they brought cursing on their life, he's going to bring blessing. In spite of the judgment they bring on themselves, he will gather them, he will restore them, he will be their God, they will be his people, and he will rule over them. All of this is woven throughout, and it's peppered throughout all of the prophets. And we can get into each of these promises. What this means for Israel, some very specific things. One day Israel will go into captivity and be taken away from their land, but one day they will return to that same land. But there's also a future promise that God will gather all of his people from all over the world and bring them back to that land, even in our future. God's ultimate goal for his people is not just so that their economy is restored, but their heart is. He instills goodness and righteousness into them. And this will all be done under the divine leadership of the Son of David, who will sit on the throne, who we know to be Jesus Christ himself. And much of this will come, he says, one day in the day of Jezreel. Much of this will come where Jesus returns and he comes to the Battle of Armageddon and takes the throne. By the way, the Armageddon is in the Valley of Jezreel. Now, those are all end times things that I kind of just tossed at you there. But this is the basic principle that lies underneath all of this. God delights in scandalous forgiveness. These people should have been thrown away then in 700 BC. But they're not thrown away now. Romans 11, has God cast away his people? God forbid. And so we can sift through this and spend hours talking about all the eschatology we have, and I could put charts up on the screens that may or may not be right. But the point would be that we have to remember that everything they deserve to lose, God would restore, not because they deserved it, but because he loves them. So I want you to flip over to the next chapter. I want you to see how he fleshes this out in chapter 2. And I have some books for you. Number one, he will give them renewed love. Renewed love. Look at verse number 13. So the first part of chapter 2 talks about all of their being destitute and the craziness of his people that he's supposed to care for being living in judgment without anything that they need. And then the second half of chapter 2 flips the script and talks about how in spite of them having judgment, he will bring them back to himself. But look at the terminology he uses. He says, I'll visit upon her, verse 13, the days of Balaam when she burned incense to them. She decked herself with earrings and jewels and she went after her lovers and forget me, saith the Lord. But then in verse 14, the whole thing turns upside down. Therefore, behold, I will allure her, bring her into the wilderness, and speak comfortably to her. Allure her. It means what it sounds like. When you first start dating somebody, guys attempt to flirt with the woman. Now, we're not very good at that, and I don't know what genetic malady we have where we don't seem to pick up on really good social cues, but regardless, we attempt to do so. We attempt to allure them. We try to smell good, at least sometimes, you know? We try not to be idiots when we're out to dinner. Now, it took me forever to get Sam to marry me and to start dating me, actually, in the first place, which I know is very surprising for all of you, but believe me, it did take place. But one of the things we joke about is when she first met me, she said she thought it was boring. And I don't know about you, I feel like I'm a very exciting person, but And the reason she thought I was boring was because I was. I was boring. I was trying so hard not to be a moron that I was just super stiff and I wasn't myself. And she said she liked me more and more the more and more I became myself. But that's the attempt. Guys aren't very good at it, but we attempt to allure when we're trying, watch, when we're trying to start a relationship. So this is what, this is the word that God uses here. And there's nothing deep about it in Hebrew at all. This is the word that God uses here. He says, just like when we began our relationship, even after all of this history we have, I'm going to go back to the dating phase and bring you back to myself, allure you, bring her into the wilderness. That sounds negative. The idea is to separate her from the rest of the people. When I was trying to date Sam, she was super popular. She had this buffer of like 15 girls around her at all times that you couldn't break through into the middle, you know? And so the only way to get a chance to talk to her was if she was like stolen from the rest of the group. And this is the picture he has here. I will take her away so that it's just her and I. And he says, I'll speak comfortably to her. That just means I will speak to her heart. This is God talking to his people. After all of this judgment language we had last week, embedded in this same chapter, he says, so I'm going to go back and bring these people back to myself. Renewed love. Now, by the way, just as a side note, a lot of those things you do when you're dating, they come naturally, right? They're volitional because you choose to do them. You know, you choose to write the poem, you choose to buy the gift, you choose to go out on the date, you choose to put on deodorant, you know, all the stuff that you're trying really hard on. But at the same time, it's also natural, right? You don't choose to have feelings, you just do, right? And a lot of us, by the way, this is a side note for all of us to mimic our character after God, a lot of us in our relationships, whether it's with our kids or whether it's with our spouse, we think that that endearingness that we have is lost because it's not automatic. But remember, love is a choice. You choose to invest in the relationships that you have. God didn't just say, man, the Israelites, they're so encouraging and I just love to be around them. I'm gonna allure them and speak comfortably in them. No, he chose to because their relationship mattered to him. And so, fellas, it doesn't matter what you feel today as much as what you choose to invest in the people around you. Because God, if he chose to act of just how it feels, remember, this illustration is supposed to show us how it feels to God when we cheat on him. If he was just acting on how he feels, he wouldn't do any of this. But because he chooses to be loving out of his character, he renews his love and allures and speaks comfortably to them. Renewed love. Number two, he gives them a renewed future. A renewed future. So what is the track they are on? Not a good one. Where is it going? Not a good place. But here he says, I will alter the destination because I'm good. Look what he says. Verse 15. I will give her her vineyards from thence and the valley of Achor for a door of hope. I'm going to talk about that in 2 seconds. And look at this. And she shall sing there as in the days of her youth, as in the day when she came up out of the land of Egypt. And this is a really cool picture. So the day that they came up out of the land of Egypt was like the beginning of their relationship with God. Like that's even how the Bible pictures it. So God promised these promises to Abraham, to Isaac, and to Jacob. And now you have all these thousands of people who are living in Egypt who are trying to sort of bank on the promises that God gave to other people hundreds of years ago. And probably expect that it's not going to come to pass. But then God sends Moses in, makes everything worse for a few weeks, which makes them more despairing. Now they have more work to do. But then as the plagues come, and Egypt's gods one by one are beaten by theirs, and then Pharaoh kicks them out, and then they think they're all going to die in the wilderness, but then they cross over the Red Sea, which has been parted for them. They get to the other side, and it's like at first clicks that, oh, God actually wants to be our God. So we will choose to be his people. And they sing a song. They all get to the other side, and there's a whole chapter in the Bible where they sing a song. And he says, remember that day? I want to bring us back to that day. I want to renew the future and make it like the beginning. He says this, out of the valley of Achor, a door of hope. So the Israelites go through the wilderness. They stay there for 40 years. They go into the promised land under Joshua. They get to their first obstacle, which is the city of Jericho. And in Jericho, they were supposed to destroy the city, and God was going to help them, but they were supposed to keep all the things there. But one man, Achan, chooses to steal from that city, gold and silver and clothes. And so he does. They're not blessed for the next battle, and so his sin gets exposed. And God, as he often does, deals very harshly with the first sin to show the precedent of how bad things really are when we step away from God's command and from his relationship. And Achan and his whole family is stoned in the valley of Achor, which is judgment. And this giant pile of stones that they left up there, which was supposed to remain unto this day, which is what Joshua said, so I don't know how long it's been there, but is a picture to them of the problems we bring upon ourselves. And he says, I want to bring us back to the day you got out of Egypt when you sang songs, and I want us to see the valley of Achor, even in the worst of our days, hope can still come out of it. Out of the valley of Achor, a door of hope. And it's the flipping of the script again. Our judgment, God can still give us mercy. Renewed love, renewed future. Number three, a renewed covenant. A renewed covenant. Verse 16, and it shall be at that day, saith the Lord, that thou shalt call me Ishi, which means husband, and shalt call me no more Ba'ali, which means master. Now that's very interesting because in certain places in the Bible, the word Ishi for husband and the word Ba'ali for master are sometimes used interchangeably. The wife might refer to the head of the household as master, or he referred to as my husband. And so it's not like one of those terms was good and one of those terms was bad. So why does he say you're not going to call me that? Well, it says in verse 17, because I'm going to take away the names of Balaam out of her mouth. The word was very closely associated. I don't even want you to say things that even sounds like Baal anymore. Baal was the other god that she had gone away and been immoral with. And he says, I want to put you in a situation where you can succeed. I want you to forget your old life, and I want you to return to a new life. And they shall be no more remembered by their name. Verse 18, and in that day, will I make a covenant with the beasts of the field and with the fowls of heaven and with the creeping things of the ground. Pause. Back in verse 12, he says that they were going to have vines and figs, and then the beasts and the fowls are going to come and eat the vines and figs, which they had planted because they were destitute, because they had run away from God, their provider. And here he says he's going to talk to those same beasts and those same fowls and make a deal with them, insinuating just a few verses later, they're not going to eat their vines, and they're not going to eat their figs, and he's not going to do that perpetually. God brings problems into our life. Sometimes that's the way it feels. The best things in our life just seem to slip away. How does Haggai say it? We'll get to that in a few months, but where we put wages into our bag, but it's filled with holes. So we look for the increase, and it seems to always be slipping away. He says, I don't want you to live there perpetually. Now, look at the end of that verse. I'll break the bow and the sword and the battle out of the earth, and I will make them to lie down safely. What is a husband and a father supposed to do for a household? Provide for the family and protect the family. And here it says, I will provide for you, and I will protect you. Verse 19, and I will betroth thee unto me forever. Yea, I will betroth thee unto me in righteousness and in judgment and in loving kindness and in mercies, and I will even betroth thee unto me in faithfulness. Betrothal has the idea of being engaged again. So we have dating, we have engagement, but in that culture, to be betrothed, to be engaged, wasn't something to get out of. You were promised to marry them. So you were legally married at that point. But he uses the word for the earliest stages, which is the most exciting and the most enjoyable and the most romantic. And he uses the word for that so that we can realize what he wants for us. And watch what he is willing to extend. A lot of people would just throw us away. He says, no, I am willing to start over again if you're willing to start over again with me. And it's not just going to be an arbitrary deal. Remember, the old covenant that God made with them was that he would be faithful to them and they would be faithful to him. They weren't very faithful. Some of the prophets then bring up the fact that God's going to make a new covenant with them, where he's going to write his law on their hearts instead of on stone somewhere else. And so out of themselves, he will change their very hearts so that they can be righteous and they can live holy. And here he says, I will renew this in loving kindness and in mercy and in righteousness and in judgment. So he is willing to bring about a renewed covenant, faithful relationship. And look at the end of that verse. And thou shalt know the Lord. I am willing to be known if you are willing to know me again. A renewed covenant. Which brings, number four, renewed blessing. Renewed blessing. When God is our God and we are his people, there is abundant overflowing that comes with that. Look at verse 21. This is a funny picture. And it shall come to pass in that day, I will hear, saith the Lord. I'll hear the heavens, they shall hear the earth. The earth shall hear the corn and the wine and the oil, and they shall hear Jezreel. What a weird passage. This is basically what it says. Jezreel, that land filled with violence and blood that's been living in unfaithfulness, will look at the corn and the wine and the oil and say, hey, provide for our needs. The corn, the wine, the oil will look at the ground and say, well, you got to give me the nutrients that I need in order to grow. And the earth looks up to heaven and says, well, then you got to give me rain if I'm going to grow. And the heavens look at God and say, well, you got to let me rain. And so God hears the heavens, and the heavens hear the earth, and the earth hears the corn and the wine and the oil, and the corn, wine, and oil hear Jezreel. See the trail? And so what does that mean, by the way? At the end of this trail of us providing for our needs is God's permission to let the rain fall. We look to the ground and say, make it work. And the end of that calling of our needs to the earth, to the heavens, at the end of it is God, who sends the blessings, or not. And here he says, I want to hear heaven, which hears earth, which hears your provision, which hears you. I want to be heard at the end of that line. I want to give renewed blessing. Verse 23. And I will sow her unto me in the earth. This is a word picture here. The word Jezreel, the name Jezreel, it means to sow. And he says, I want Jezreel not to be a place of barrenness. I want it to be a place of life. So rather than Jezreel betraying their identity and being plucked up, God is sowing her again. Look at the end of that verse. I will have mercy upon her that have not obtained mercy. And I will say to them that which are not my people, thou art my people, and they shall say, thou art my God. He says it here in chapter 2. He also said it in chapter 1. I'm going to bring it up here. Now, this is a very interesting passage that comes up in the New Testament. I will say to people who are not my people, you are my people. 1 Peter brings this up. I want you to look at these notes because this is cool, and I'm going to finish up here in just a second. When Peter talks to the scattered people all around the world, Bithynia, Asia, Cappadocia, and he says all these people just being scattered because they're Christians and being thrown around the world, we have to remember that even when nobody else says that we belong, we do belong. We might not belong to our country, but we do belong to our citizenship in heaven. And he says, you are a chosen generation, a royal priesthood, a holy nation, a peculiar people. Even if you feel as a Christian like a man in a country, you have a country to which you belong. Look at what he says, that he should show forth the praises of him who has called you out of darkness into his marvelous light, verse 10, which in time past were not a people, but are now the people of God, which had not obtained mercy, but now have obtained mercy. Now, I want you to look at Romans chapter 9, too. This is one of the other places. So Peter says this as well. But Paul, see, he applies it very interesting. In Romans chapter 9, he's talking about the people of Israel. Israel. God has given blessings to Israel. God loves his people, Israel. God has covenanted with Israel, Israel. And he's given grace to Israel. He's given mercy to Israel. And they didn't deserve it, but he gave it to them anyway. And then he says, so does that mean that all of God's blessings stops with them? I mean, that's where we are in the minor prophets. Israel, Israel, Israel. What about me? I'm not Jewish. Well, this is what Paul says. Romans chapter 9. What if God, willing to show his wrath and to make his power known, endured with much long suffering the vessels of wrath fitted to destruction? With all the Israelites, he endured them, even though they constantly put themselves in a position to be destroyed. He endured them anyway. And that he might make known the riches of his glory on the vessels of mercy, which he afore prepared unto glory. Even us, whom he hath called, not of the Jews only, but also of the Gentiles. As he saith, verse 25, also in Osi, that is the way you would have spelled Hosea in Greek. So Paul says, what if he decided to show mercy to other people? Because like he said in Hosea, I will call them my people, which were not my people, and her beloved, which was not beloved. And it shall come to pass that in the place where it was said unto them, ye are not my people, there shall they be called the children of the living God. And he quotes this chapter in Hosea. So what is Paul trying to tell us? Paul's not trying to say that all along the book of Hosea had nothing to do with the Israelites, and that it actually was about us all along. This is all Paul is saying. Why would God extend mercy to us Gentile people in spite of his chosen people, the Israelites? And he says, well, I don't know. Remember in Hosea where God showed us how even Hosea, who was faithful, married this immoral wife that she was not her people. She has not loved. She had only filled the land with violence and blood. And God said to them, you weren't my people, but I'm going to call you my people anyway. It says, if we remember that, that tells us something about God. God is a God who delights in calling people who don't deserve to be his people, his people. God is a God who delights in calling people who don't deserve his mercy, that they will have his mercy. God is a God who delights in scandalous forgiveness. And so should we be surprised if his forgiveness extends to us? Hosea tells us no, we should not. Now, you might say, why is this so scandalous? Well, he shows us in the illustration. Turn to chapter 3 and we'll be finished. We started with Hosea and his wife, and he ends this section with Hosea and his wife. Then said the Lord unto me, verse number 1, go yet a love a woman, beloved of her friend, yet an adulteress, according to the love of the Lord toward the children of Israel. So what he says here is, Hosea, go love a woman who is beloved of her friend. Somebody else. She's developed a relationship with somebody else. She's an adulteress. According to the love I have with the children of Israel, who took other gods and loved flagons of wine. And so, Hosea says, I bought her to me for 15 pieces of silver and for an omer of barley and a half an omer of barley. And I said unto her, thou shalt abide for me many days. Thou shalt not play the harlot. Thou shalt not be for another man. And so will I also be for thee. So he buys her. He buys her for 15 pieces of silver and an omer and a half of barley. So several things we learn from this. Apparently this woman, as she goes away with in adultery and in immorality, landed in a place to be bought for the price of a slave because he buys her back. Why would you have to do that unless she was on the market? But he doesn't pay with 30 pieces of silver. He pays with 15 pieces of silver, and then he pays with barley, which he has in his pantry. So what does that tell us? He must not have had 30 pieces of silver sitting around, but had to scrounge up the money to buy his wife back off of this slave block so he could live with her again. And we're supposed to see this picture of Hosea not just letting her go, but bringing her back and say, that's what God does to you. And he delights in doing it. And it's a scandalous thing. But this is the God that we have. We place ourselves in spiritual bondage to the sins of this world and think God would never want me. And in all his righteousness, he would never stoop to rescue someone who has been unfaithful as I have been. But Jesus Christ gave all that he had so he could purchase adulterous slaves to sin and live with us. because God is scandalously loving. And so that's how the minor prophets begin. As Hosea moves forward and talks about in what ways we have been adulterous, we're supposed to see it in context of the relationship that God desires to keep and to hold on to. And that when he calls us to repentance, he means that there is always a path to return if we choose to take it. So we'll start on that next week. Let's pray. We need to finish up. Father, thank you for our time together today. We thank you for your word and the gracious gifts that it teaches us. Help us to understand.